From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's poetry, short stories, and creative nonfiction with three North Carolina-based writers. The Carolina African American Writers Collective came into being 25 years ago. The publication of the anthology, All the Songs We Sing, celebrates this anniversary. Jackie Shelton Green, North Carolina Poet Laureate, introduces the collection with this: "All the songs we sing draws us near while pushing us away. This raw, terrifying, necessary, and beautiful book is a rich orchestration of memoir, essays, fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction that bears witness to the hushed songbirds of captivity belonging to a collective past whose future generations sing proud and out loud." Today, we're going to meet the founder and executive director of the Carolina African American Writers Collective, Lenar D. Moore, who is also a poet and anthologist. In 2008, Moore became the first Southerner and the first African American to be elected as president of the Haiku Society of America. He was reelected in 2009. He is executive chairman of the North Carolina Haiku Society. Lenar D. Moore, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you with us today. And also with us, two of the contributing writers to the anthology. Angela Belcher Epps is the author of Salt in the Sugar Bowl, a novella. Her stories and creative nonfiction have appeared in Main Street Rag, Moonshine Review, When Women Awaken, Obsidian, Literature and the African Diaspora, Reflections Literary Journal, Essence Magazine, The Ladies' Home Journal. The list goes on. Angela Belcher Epps, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And Bridget A. Lacey is an award-winning journalist who wrote the column Morsels for the Raleigh News and Observer for many years. She still freelances for that publication, writing about food, art, and culture. Her stories have also appeared in Our State Magazine, Salt Magazine, Divinity Magazine, The Independent Weekly, and the North Carolina Arts Council. She is the author of the cookbook Sunday Dinner, part of the Savor the South series by UNC Press. Bridget Lacey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel.
And we are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for any of our three guests, you can send us an email during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. Lenar D. Moore, tell us first why you founded the Carolina African American Writers Collective back in 1995. What need were you filling that didn't exist then?
Well, I actually took a poetry writing class before that time. I took a beginning in 1988, and then 1989 was the advanced poetry writing class at NC State with Professor Gerald Barrett, who a renowned poet in his own right. And in that class, Janice W. Hodges and I were the only African Americans. So when we would get time to critique our work, there were times when we had to explain cultural references or give some historical background. So that took a lot of time away from our critique or workshop, and then each student had only about 15 minutes to workshop his or her work, a poem. So I told Janice that I was going to start a group. So it took some years to get to that point, you know, had some false starts in the beginning. And so moving forward to 1995 and up into this point, here we are.
And what does the Carolina African American Writers Collective do now? Is it, do you get together regularly? Is it sort of like a professional association? What do you do?
Well, we did until March when the pandemic came. Yeah, we got together monthly, except during the summer months. So I guess we would meet during the academic year. And the first 6 or 7 years we met at my house, and then we began to meet at libraries and culture centers, and then to different members' houses. And what I love about that, we have some of the members who would cook meals, and you have Angela up here. Oh, wow. She's a great cook. So I can't tell all of that. We have to keep our members to ourselves. So,
well, so Angela Belcher Epps is secretly a great cook, and Bridget Lacey is the publisher, the writer of a cookbook, Sunday Dinner, and also writes food and culture and arts pieces for the News and Observer.
Bridget is a great cook too.
And we're going to talk about some of that in a minute, but when you think back to what drove you to create this writers collective and the extra education that you had to undertake before this existed, how have things changed over the last 25 years? Have they changed as much as you thought they would have by the year 2020 or not?
Well, there have been some changes, you know. Maybe, you know, people are reading more African-American works and so forth, and studying the culture and reading a history about African-American life and experiences. So I would think so.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come up with this idea to publish an anthology of poetry, short stories, and creative nonfiction?
Well, the writers themselves kind of led me to that. I saw how good the work was becoming in the workshops and the meetings, and how we all were working together. And sometimes it seems as if we would all bring works on the same theme. And so the way we were kind of like in unison and working together and on the same theme, same subject sometimes, and as I said, the quality of the work led me to that. And of course, we wanted to commemorate the 25th anniversary.
Right. Bridget Lacey, the piece that you contributed to this anthology, Sense and Sensibility, The Loss of Smell Brings an Unexpected Gift. What led to your writing that piece?
Well, in 1999, when Hurricane Floyd came, I had a floater in my eye, and I went to the doctor that night as it was raining and carrying on. And the eye doctor told me I needed to get to a hospital, to the emergency room. And about 5 hours later, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor the size of a tennis ball. And so I had surgery and did a story called The Storm in My Head for the News and Observer a year later, talking about that journey. But Sense and Sensibility was an additional essay that I had written. I wrote it about 10 years after the fact, and then it kind of just stood there for almost 10 years. And then I took it to the workshop and actually, critiqued. Everybody, you know, we hand out copies of our work, people make suggestions. And I was able to sharpen that piece from their feedback and then start sending it out. And it initially was published in Salt Magazine. But I thought it was a great example of how this collective works, how you have your material, you work, you sharpen, you get your critique, and then you sharpen some more and send it out to the world.
Can you, and I want to talk about that process a little bit. I'm going to have you read from your essay, I think, when we come back in the second segment. I don't think we'll have enough time here. But can you just talk a little bit about what it's like to put this work out there, especially work that is nonfiction? It's about your personal experience. Is that hard to have people give you criticism, even if it's well-intended criticism?
You know, I think it's not hard only because I've been doing it so long. You know, when I first started off as a reporter, I remember writing a story about a woman who had, quote, a Morris cat. And I went to her house and she had like 100 cats. And so she was like, oh, it doesn't even smell in here. And I was like, don't close the door. And I remember going back to the newspaper and they said, what happened? And I said, the woman had 100 cats. And they said, oh, she's violating the law. She should only have 3 cats. And so I was feeling really bad that I had to tell on the cat lady. And then she came to the newspaper and she was really upset with me. And she said, I told that girl I had 50 cats, where there was still 47 too many. But that's when I first started learning. And this was my first internship in the early 80s, that, you know, telling stories is a tough business. You have to have courage. You have to be a lion to tell a story.
So that story went from being what you thought was going to be kind of a fun featurey piece into a hard news story about violating animal ordinances.
That's correct.
And it's also, go ahead.
She called me a fake feline lover too. I mean, she was very upset with me, but I mean, the story has to speak for itself.
And that's interesting too, that the memory of telling that story involves smell for you. When,
yes,
this piece that you're going to read for us in a little while is about the loss of your sense of smell and what that has meant in your life.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at poetry, short stories, and essays with 3 North Carolina-based writers. When we come back from this break, we're actually going to hear Bridget Lacy read from her piece, Sense and Sensibility, and we'll find out how Leonard Moore discovered haiku as his poetic form. We'll also hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. All the Songs We Sing is an anthology of poetry, short stories, and creative nonfiction published on the 25th anniversary of the Carolina African American Writers Collective. Today, we're talking with the collective's founder and executive director, Leonard Moore, who is also a contributor, and 2 other contributing writers, Bridget Lacy and Angela Belcher Epps. You can ask your own question of all 3 of the writers on this Wednesday, June 24th, by sending us an email at coastline@whqr.org. And Bridget Lacy, just before we went to break, we were talking about what led up to your writing Sense and Sensibility. Would you now read a portion of that for us?
Absolutely. Maybe I should have taken more time to smell the fragrant rosemary in my yard, or I should have soaked in my almond-scented bubble bath more often. Perhaps I should have savored the sweetness of my Uncle Jack's red roses instead of assuming they would always be there for me. 19 years ago, when I lost my sense of smell, my ability to relish those simple pleasures went away. I never thought at 37 years old, my olfactory nerve would be taken by a benign brain tumor the size of a tennis ball. So when my neurosurgeon told me that losing my ability to smell was one of the side effects of brain surgery, the reality of what that meant didn't sink in. How could it? After all, I was facing life or death.
And for those of us who are just joining us, this was about the surgery for the tumor that led to your loss of smell. And you talk about later in that piece, other senses were heightened as a result, or who knows, I can't say that, but can you just talk about the heightening of other senses and what that has meant for you?
Well, I think not just the heightening, Rachel, but I think the savoring and not taking anything for granted. You know, we often save our good stuff, whether it's your china or your perfume. And what the loss of smell meant to me is use the good stuff now. You know, this afternoon is not promised. You know, so sometimes I would, you know, put on a nice perfume just to have someone else say, "You smell good." That felt nice, even though I couldn't smell myself. So I think that it's, you know, you appreciate the world a little differently when something so significantly has been taken away from you.
And especially your interest in the culinary arts. You wrote a cookbook. Did you write that cookbook before or after this surgery?
After the surgery. You know, I have to say I must have good genes because people always associate smell with taste, but my taste buds are just as good as they were. And it was interesting because several years ago, I did a story on a candy man. This is a man who made chocolate candy. And he had me taste different candies. And I was with one of my editors and I could tell him what the ingredients were before she could, even though she could smell and I couldn't. So I just think, I thank my wonderful family for sharp taste buds.
That's incredible because I always thought that smell was a component of the taste sense.
They are, but a lot of what you think you taste, you smell. So I will say now, if you put me in the car with a bucket of chicken, I can't wait till I get home to put my hand in the bucket.
I want to go to Angela Belcher Epps. You wrote Sophia, which is actually an excerpt from your novella, Salt in the Sugar Bowl. And I would love to have you read part of that as well. But before you do, can you just talk about how Salt in the Sugar Bowl emerged?
Yes, I conceived of Sophia as a character because I wanted to talk about the flawed nature of individuals and how that impacts families. I deal quite a bit in my writing with issues, whatever they are, that keep us from living satisfied, successful lives. So I set Sophia up to be a woman who leaves her children. And that seems that it would be the crux of the novella. But the crux of the novella is what that impact of loss has on her six children. Because I really do believe that abandonment and loss are key components of misery in our society, you know, whether it's from, you know, death or divorce, migration away from one's culture, whatever that is, loss resides in our hearts in ways that have to be reconciled in some way if we're going to live well and be peaceful. So that was the setup for Sophia. So even though she has her own chapter, she starts out the novella. It's her own connection to being authentic, to being happy, to being connected with what's real in her life that leads her to move on. And then each subsequent chapter visits one of her adult children to see how that loss affected their ability to live as a family member, as an individual.
And may I just say before you read this, when you talk about a woman leaving her six children, that may be, at least culturally, one of the least forgivable things that a woman, a mother, can do. And yet, in this excerpt, you bring us so inside her that we understand and we can forgive and we can go with her on that journey.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because that was definitely the hardest part of the novel because I truly did understand the abandonment issues just from things that have happened in my own life with death and, you know, dislocation, things of that nature. But I didn't know how to reconcile, like I said, that sin of leaving children. But I think it's important that we understand the internal landscape of an individual, because there is a need to save oneself. And the further away you get from self, the harder that becomes. So I set up Sophia as sort of a victim of her mother. Her mother was very superficial. She thought she could create a person who would fit into this culture, this society. But in so doing, she removed Sophia's personhood. And I think that happens quite often. There's this disconnection from self that leaves an individual, a soul, pretty much wandering and unsettled. So the notion of grounding is what I rely on time and time again to write about, to try to shed light on that need for grounding so that we can move forward in just more informed and healthy ways.
Yeah. Would you read for us from Sophia?
I will.
Thank you.
I'm going to read the section that shows her inauthenticity. Let's see. Devorah is Sophia's mother. Devorah cut out pictures from magazines and bought makeup. She paid for her daughter's Friday evening hairdresser appointments, and she coaxed Sophia to spend entire paychecks on dresses that lifted her average-sized breasts and cinched her non-existent waist. It was 1964, and while most Maxton County women were still modest in their knee-length shirtwaists, Devorah's magazines were showing dresses way up on the thigh, so it didn't matter how much of a waist her daughter didn't have when a dress was that short. Sophia was 19 and marriage was fine for the first few months because she and Hunter lived with Devorah while he finished out his contract. Sophia and Devorah hadn't thought much about what to do once she moved to her own house in Hayden and couldn't match colors or season a chicken or hem her dresses or apply false eyelashes on her own. In no time, Hunter was asking why he kept getting strangled with too much vinegar.
You know, that story at the end, of course, Sophia's left her children and she's stepping away from her old life, but she hasn't yet stepped into this new life. And there's this moment when she asks herself what her favorite color is. She has to ask herself that question. And then she lands on blue. And it's just, I mean, it's profound because it's everything that you explained before you read that excerpt about reconnecting with this human that she doesn't know at all.
Absolutely. And I think in our society, many of us find ourselves having to purposefully revisit ourselves if we can find the time and the space and even know how to begin to do that.
Yeah. And so one more question about Sophia before we get into poetry, but Angela Belcher Epps, are her children better off without her? Is she right about that?
No, that's a complicated question, but no, they're not better off without her because there is a need for a mother. They all flounder. There is an inability to create the house. And I think that holistic need of family, of contributors, is something that we have to pay more attention to. Mothers often teach us how to be more human because their father is hardworking, he's well-intentioned, but he doesn't lend a view of the world that mothers can bring. So each of them suffers in their own way. And my goal was to show the many faces of abandonment, because quite often people will think that, oh, one pines or one acts out, but people become codependent. They love too much. They love too little. They withdraw too soon. They visit these issues on their children. So no, they're not better off without her, but it's a realistic problem that we all face. And I want to examine what it looks like to deal with those abandonment issues once they're there. So that's why she is gone.
Thank you for that. Leonard Moore, you wrote the poem, The Interrogation of Harriet Tubman. And of course, I'd like to have you read that. But before you do, is there anything you'd like to tell us about it?
Well, I thought I would just create a persona poem and have an imaginary way Harriet speak a little bit about her life or what was happening. So that's what I was doing with that piece.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, can you, the term that you use to describe the poem?
The term that I use to describe it?
Yeah, perhaps I misheard, but go ahead and then we'll discuss after you read.
Interrogation of Harriet Tubman. You say I should escape with you, follow the North Star that spills light like my good breast drips milk. I've already had my children snatched from me as if they were brown eggs in some nest. So you think I'm going to trust you? What I'm going to eat? An oak leaf? A pine needle? A twig? My feet feel like axed wood. My body feels like a sack of sweet potatoes. You brave woman going to poke that pistol in my side? Make me walk? I don't know what Massa might think. He said, I was real good. And you say, you're taking me to freedom? That's as wide as this pitch black night. Can you tell me what's waiting for us in the thicket? Will a horseman be there with his long black whip, a gun slung over his shoulder to take us back to that plantation? So why should I follow you and the North Star tonight? I hear a growl to my right. I hear a yowl to my left. You say, keep walking with my feet straight ahead, quick and quiet. I think about my three children snatched and sold. I want them back. Will I ever see them again? I push back branches, duck limbs, and sidestep weeds. No water here. Can your pistol shoot the horseman off his horse without missing him? I think I forget that my feet ache. My hands sweat with each dark mile. Sure we won't see coffles again? Sure we won't witness whips again. Sure, we won't hear auction forces again.
Thank you. Leonard Moore reading his poem, The Interrogation of Harriet Tubman. How did you inhabit her, Leonard, to write that poem?
Well, of course, I've read about Harriet in my studies and also in my teaching. And so I can't really imagine what it was like, but, you know, have empathy for and try to incorporate some of the pain in there somehow and try to texturize the poem with specificity, concrete details and so forth in there. Mm-hmm.
And you also wrote, actually, before we get to that, can you talk about how you found poetry as your form?
I think poetry found me. I always loved music and lyrics and singing in church and then hearing music when I was little. So I think dealing with that too, because I wrote some lyrics early on. And then poetry, but you know, at first I thought poetry had to rhyme. I continued to work with it. So I think because poetry evokes emotion and has rhythm, that's what drew me to poetry.
You're listening to Coastline. Today it's poetry and short stories and creative nonfiction. We're exploring the anthology, All the Songs We Sing, published on the 25th anniversary of the Carolina African American Writers Collective. With us today, Leonard Moore, poet, anthologist, and founder and executive director of the Carolina African American Writers Collective, Angela Belcher Epps, contributing writer and author of the novella Salt in the Sugar Bowl, and Bridget Lacey, contributing writer, journalist, and author of the cookbook Sunday Dinner, part of the Savor the South series by UNC Press. And they're answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can email us during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. Leonard Moore, you also, I mean, you not only found poetry or poetry found you, but you found the form of haiku. How is that different from the other poetry that you write?
Actually, haiku might have found me too. What happened about 5 months after I got out of the Army, I was in bed sick, I guess with the flu, January 1982. And so I looked in my literature book that I had in Germany, overseas branch, University of Maryland, and I noticed haiku was in there. And I thought I could write haiku by looking at those examples. Wrong, that was naive. It's not as simple as it seems to be.
And what makes haiku so difficult? For those who aren't familiar with the form, what is that form?
Well, there are so many other things you must have in your haiku or you could work with. You know, in school, we might be taught 5, 7, 5 syllables and 3 lines. Well, contemporary haiku poets don't adhere to that strict syllable count. Maybe more or less 3, 5, 3 beats or something like that. But also, haiku will have a kigo, K-I-G-O, which means season word. And so you have a word in there that references the season. Also, there's a contrast in the haiku. There are many things. It would take a long time to talk about that. Maybe I could just read haiku.
Sure. And I'm going to have you do that when, because we're coming close to a break and I don't want you to get cut off when you're reading your poem. But can you talk about what it's like to, well, we'll talk about that when we come back from the break too. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at poetry, short stories, and personal essays with 3 North Carolina writers today, talking about the newly published anthology, All the Songs We Sing. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. We'll have one more segment when we come back from this break for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The Carolina African American Writers Collective is celebrating its 25th year with the release of the anthology All the Songs We Sing, a collection of poetry, short stories, and nonfiction essays. With us today, the founder and executive director of the Writers Collective, Leonard Moore, and 2 contributing writers, Bridget Lacey and Angela Belcher Epps. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday, June 24th, by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Leonard Moore, before you read, I wanted to ask you about the process of criticism and feedback in the collective with haiku. Is this a form that many people in the collective feel, I don't know, versed in talking about? It sounds like such a specialty.
There are a few of us. Well, you know, I taught haiku in one of the workshops there, or maybe 2. but there are a few of us. In fact, in 2017, five of us are in the anthology One Window's Light. And that we have five collective members in there.
And sorry, this is a rookie, you know, non-literary question, but when you get together, do people who generally express in other forms comment on a form that might not be theirs, or is that pretty segmented?
Well, when we do the forms, basically, we also write in our workshop. So we would teach that, you know, we do poetry, we do essays, sometimes flash fiction, whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm. You also wrote Reminiscing Daddy, and this is about the loss of your daughter. Can you speak about that?
Well, yeah, this month made 16 years ago that I lost her. She was in an accident. And so I wrote this poem. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Would you read that for us?
Okay. A Reminiscing Daddy. Daddy, where are you? You ask. Words wing through your cell phone. Our cell phones, that sunlit day when I drove onto campus, your first semester, full smile cut clean across my mouth. You're here, you're outside, you're here, you're outside. I pulled up to your dorm in Greenville where I had run trike the mile relay 25 years ago. It wasn't long before I know your bird quick words, their cadence against my ear, made me believe in inquiry. You're here, you're outside, you're here, you're outside. Now you're 3 years dead, your twisted car long since scrapped, your dresses still hang in the closet in your room where your mother and I half sleep, half listen to rain, half wake for your return. You're here, you're outside.
Thank you for that. A Reminiscing Daddy by Leonard Moore. She wrote a haiku. Are you the one who introduced her to that form? And is this something that you knew about, that she shared with you, or did you find it later?
Yeah, she shared this poem with me when we were riding, going somewhere, and she recited the poem, and then I wrote it down, and then, you know, she wrote haiku on her own too. So certainly she and I would talk about haiku and read haiku to each other. So here's one of her haiku. And this one she composed when she was about 5 years old, five or six. The dark rock road, a car coming down it, me and my daddy. Then these haiku she wrote much later. We were on a flight headed to the Bahamas. And so she came and took my journal and went back up to her seat and wrote these haiku and handed my journal back to me. My Bohemian haiku. Bohemian dew upon the leaning palm. Morning sun shines bright. Glazed and prime conch shells appeal to my shopping eye. Sun hot and blinding. Pool water splashing. Scorched hot pink ceramic tile struck by naked sun.
Leonard Moore. Angela Belcher Epps, you also wrote a piece for the anthology called, and actually, was this written for the anthology, or was it something that was published elsewhere and included, called
it
Perennials?
Yes, it was published elsewhere and then included.
And this, it begins anyway as this exploration of how you're dealing with the death of your mother, what you expected versus what you're actually experiencing. Can you just talk about sitting down to write that? Was this kind of a fully formed piece in your imagination before you actually started writing? How did that emerge?
It was actually all a sensory experience. I was literally sitting on the steps and just reflecting on having come up the driveway, because I did. I turned in. It was the first time I was visiting my mother's home since she died. And I had so much anxiety. I mean, I was, you know, just paralyzed almost. And I turned into the driveway and there were signs of her garden coming up everywhere. And it just, everything just sort of lifted and I felt free. And I felt this eternal sort of connection to all the women who had come before us. And I was no longer alone. And so I sat on the steps with a pad and I almost wrote it verbatim, just beginning to end before I put the pen down, because it was all the memories of her plants and inside, outside, you know, who she'd been. And those gardens are part of who we are in my family.
And you talk about, I mean, you really bring this home with the description of the plant that your great grandmother planted that may have been older than you at that point.
Yes, it's incredible. I mean, it's such a rich, I guess, heritage, because I am urban as well. I spent most of my time in New York City, but my mother, my grandparents all were in Down East, North Carolina. And I'll say how powerful this is, because my aunt and I were visiting a cousin, and she has the plant that my great grandmother had. Her mother had it in her garden. She moved there. And my aunt now has dementia, but she works in the flowers at the residence in which she lives. So it's like something in our souls that connect us all, and it's beyond mind or, you know, intention. It's just there in us.
Mm-hmm. Hence the title, Perennials. And so you grew up in New York City. When you came back to North Carolina, was there an adjustment for you? I mean, in Perennials, you talk about being in New York in this melting pot classroom. How different is the non-melting pot here in North Carolina compared to how you were, what you were around when you were in your formative years?
Well, I think place is so indicative of how we experience whatever phase of life we're in. So Raleigh is almost a blend of that Down East experience and the New York, the Brooklyn, New York experience. So Raleigh was not an adjustment, and that's where I live. But when I go to Plymouth Down East, there's still a real separation of race and culture. You know, we live in a community that my great, great grandfather got after slavery, and all the lots are divided among cousins and so forth. So it's very insular. And I can see just remnants of that slave past still there. I think 2 miles down the road from that same porch where I wrote Perennials, a friend pointed out last year that there's a noose hanging from the tree that's been there since, you know, it was a plantation, and that it belongs to that family, so they don't remove it. And, you know, just that's a part of the landscape, and it's accepted. It hasn't been questioned because there is that continuity of place. So seeing those kinds of differences informs the way we process depending on where we are. We shift. I think that's, we're soul shifters in a way, depending on where we happen to be.
There's a noose that is still there because it's on private property. So am I understanding this correctly, that the family that owns that property wants to keep that
right
there as a sign of what? White supremacy?
Is that what we're... I suppose. And I think in so many rural communities, it's an unspoken agreement that you know who is a hater of sorts, and it's accepted, and you coexist. It's because it's the same terrain the history happened. So there hasn't been any concrete demarcation of this is now not acceptable, now it is. I mean, it's just a linear overlapping continuity of history in the making. And yes, it's still there and it's part of the landscape.
And do you write about coexisting with that? How do you coexist with that?
The way I address that is you can't necessarily change the hearts of other people. Over time, whenever something hateful happens, I've always said, any friend will tell you, I say, oh, I'm not surprised. The same people who were fighting, you know, to segregate the schools are still alive. If I remember it, then they're still here. You know, they are still there. So that's a reality. So my way of dealing with that is to empower people who are oppressed and who are living in that landscape to see where their opportunities to overcome that would be. So one of my main characters, one of Sophia's daughters, actually is very enterprising. She's more authentic than the other. She was younger, so she was sort of self-made. And I use her as a symbol of someone who creates a stronger person than her family, her environment, because she's a survivor. And survivors can sometimes go places that the comfortable can't. So that's what I do, is I create characters who are strong enough to overcome and write a new history, because history won't be given to you. It has to be written. And I want to write the everyday person becoming more than they had to be or were expected to be.
Bridget Lacy. Yes, go ahead.
Well, you kind of asked about, you know, inclusiveness or diversity. And I think Sunday dinner is one of those ways. I think that when you invite people to your table, that's a way of starting a dialogue. I mean, Sunday dinner is not just about the food. It's really about that fellowship. It's really kind of seeing what we have that's alike, not just things that are unlike. So I think that's a really good way to start a dialogue once the pandemic is over. I think is to invite people that maybe you don't know or you want to understand for Sunday dinner.
So this is something, you know, in Wilmington, which has its own fraught history with the 1898 coup d'etat and the Wilmington 10. And, you know, now the city is looking at plans to possibly remove Confederate monuments under the aegis of a public safety threat, which for now might be a temporary removal. With all this happening amid the pandemic, how would you encourage people? I mean, reaching out to people that we don't know or people that maybe, you know, we don't naturally run into. What can you tell us about the best way to reach out, get past some of the awkwardness of the divide and come together? I mean, how do you do that?
I think one way is to read people's stories, read people's narratives, understand the history of where they've been. You know, Doris Sanders said, if you ask a Southerner where they're going, they'll tell you where they've been and all the things in between. I think that there are so many people who really don't understand African-American history. You know, I grew up in Washington, D.C., read a lot of Black history, but I think there are a lot of people who really don't understand our struggle. Yes. And so a good way to do that is to read books like All the Songs We Sing and see the African-American lens.
Okay. Yes, and we are out of time. That is this edition of Coastline. Bridget Lacy, Angela Belter Epps, Leonard Moore, thank you so much for being with us. The book is All the Songs We Sing, published by Blair. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of the episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.
Thank you.